That was quite a parable. A rough working definition of a parable, which comes from the New Testament scholar C.H. Dodd, is this. It's quite long. It's quite wordy. Pay attention. A metaphor or simile drawn from nature or common life, arresting the hearer by its vividness or strangeness, and leaving the mind in sufficient doubt about its precise application to tease it into active thought. It's good, isn't it? Leaving the mind in sufficient doubt about its precise application to tease it into active thought. I hope you have been teased into active thought already this morning. Now, usually that teasing strangeness is located inside the parable. Something happens in the story that runs counter to our expectations or to common sense. The shepherd who risks 99 sheep just to find the one that is lost. It doesn't really make sense. A mustard seed that grows not into a mustard plant, but into a tree big enough for the birds of the air to nest in. But what about the parable that we just heard? A very rich man, needing to be away, puts his estate into the hands of people who work for him, who are, in fact, owned by him as part of that very estate. On his return, he rewards those who enriched him still further and punishes the one who simply held his wealth steady. Well, where's the strangeness in that? Doesn't that actually sort of sound just like the way things work? A very rich man divides up his financial portfolio amongst three investors. Two of them invest the money in the latest thing, Bitcoin perhaps, or subprime repackaged short term, I don't know what all the words are. And the wealth multiplies beyond imagining. They obviously got out in time. The third advisor, however, puts the money in a safety deposit box. It is already an enormous sum, after all, and the market is risky. And those latest instruments, well, they seem a little ethically questionable. And then the rich man returns and metes out rewards and punishments just as you'd expect. After all, he is a man used to reaping where he does not sow. And from what I've read, this scenario describes an equally likely way of doing business 2,000 years ago, with different financial instruments, of course. A way that both the Torah and Jesus repeatedly condemn. And in fact, literally burying your excess wealth in the ground was considered a responsible, prudent, ethically sound course of action, contrasting favorably with either exploitative landholding practices or the earning of interest that allows the rich to reap where they do not sow. And that is where the strangeness of this parable lies. It lies in the disconnect between the story and what Jesus usually teaches about wealth and reward and the nature of God and God's kingdom, which should make us pause, tease us into active thought, and wonder that perhaps this parable isn't actually about wealth at all, and may not even be about the kingdom of God. So then what is it about? A talenta, the Greek word translated as talent, was a unit of money equal to something like 15 years of wages for a day laborer. It's an astonishing amount of money. And it is being distributed to these slaves in multiples. So I think we can reasonably understand that we have entered into the tone of storytelling here. This is not literal money. It is an amount that represents everything, not just money, everything, not just talents in the modern English sense, everything. Now, it's not surprising that we get distracted by the idea of lots and lots of money in the story. Money tends to get our attention. But distracted by the money, we risk missing the point. The first two slaves took everything and risked it, committing themselves completely to the project at hand. They were bold and brave with everything the master had given them, unlike the fearful third slave. And this is why the first were rewarded, not because they turned a profit, but because they were not fearful. This is what we are called to do, to be bold and brave, so bold and brave, in fact, that it might even look foolish, scandalous even. And that is the last shall be first and the first shall be last message in this parable, I think. We're used to hearing that lesson illustrated with the wealthy being humbled and the humble being brought high, but the point is the same. The reasonably, cautiously responsible will be last, and the passionately, foolishly bold will be first. Which I suspect means trouble for us. I suspect that we are mostly among the reasonable and the respectable, settling in to await the kingdom with patience and quiet self-reliance, and wishing that everyone else would just do the same. But this is not the kind of waiting that Jesus describes. This story of the slaves and their money management comes in a stream of stories which Jesus tells in response to one request from his disciples. Tell us, they say to Jesus, when will the temple be destroyed? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Jesus, of course, refuses to give a simple answer. And after a rather terrifying description of what the end of the age will look like, he tells them not when to expect it, or what the kingdom itself will be like. Those stories are elsewhere. But rather, how they should wait for it. These stories that we have been hearing in these weeks are not kingdom stories. They are waiting stories, telling us how to be, what to do in the before time, which is the now time. Be like the faithful and dedicated servant who works hard and with integrity even while the master is away. Be like the attentive and ready and prepared bridesmaids who brought the extra oil. Be like the bold, risk-taking, initiative-taking slaves. Because the waiting time is not simply putting in the time. We are to throw ourselves into the time so that when the waiting is over, we have an account of how we lived it. So what might that waiting, bold, brave, committed, look like? Assuming it's not, in fact, about getting rich. Our tradition and our world are full of examples, inspiring and unsettling to those of us still committed to caution and reasonableness. That kind of waiting looks like the disciples leaving behind family and livelihood to follow this man who speaks to their soul. It looks like parents willing to put everything on the line in order to unconditionally love and support their child. It looks like St. Francis of Assisi walking away from all that wealth, giving it to the poor. It looks like Archbishop Oscar Romero speaking hard and true words to the political and the religious authorities, no matter the cost. It looks like Jesus hanging on the cross. That's what it looks like in the lives of those people. Those people are not you. What does it look like in your life? What does it look like in our collective community life? What risks are we taking? What risks are we not taking? And these are not risks just for riskiness' sake, just for show. If we sneak a peek ahead to next week's gospel portion, we see that when the one whose return we are waiting for, our bridegroom, our master, our king, we see what it is we will be asked to give an account for in our waiting time. Did you feed the hungry? Did you clothe the naked? Did you visit the sick? Did you accompany the imprisoned? Did you pour yourself out in acts of justice and mercy and humility, giving everything you have and everything you are? Did you do as Jesus would have you do, as Jesus himself did? Read this way, the parable of the talents subverts any interpretation that tries to make it about wealth or even really about the sound management of our many and varied resources, time, treasure, and talent. Instead, we are challenged to live without fear for the sake of the kingdom, to take risks, to commit ourselves completely, even if it seems foolhardy to worldly eyes. And in return, having been trustworthy in a few things, we are promised an even greater share in the responsibility of our master. Because fearlessness begets fearlessness. And as we stretch and grow and risk and reach, we get better and better at it. Better able to respond boldly and creatively to the challenges that face our world and our church, better able to give generously of ourselves, better able to see Christ everywhere we look. Such a life as that is a worthy way to wait. Such a life as that will truly prepare us to enter into the joy of the kingdom.